You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk with an Eau Claire native who's biking across the country this summer to help raise awareness and money for Syrian refugees. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. The two-week manhunt for a Wisconsin fugitive came to an end early this morning. We'll find out about that. And Wisconsin is changing up its license plates. Robert Mentzer joins us now. He's a storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin with us every Friday to look at the big Wisconsin news of the week. Rob, welcome back.
Hi, thanks.
Well, Rob, let's talk about the big news. Just heard a bit of it there about the capture of Jakubowski. What do we know about how he was apprehended?
So, you know, of course, this just happened this morning, so some of the details are just coming out, but it's a fascinating story. So, I think that, the top of the hour news had the sort of basic facts, right? This guy who stole a bunch of guns and sent a deranged manifesto to the president and made threats of violence was the subject of a massive manhunt and was caught early this morning, is arrested. A TV station that has an affiliate out in western Wisconsin in that area has an interview with the property owner, Jeffrey Gorn, who found Jakubowski camping on his land there in Vernon County. The guy was driving his four-wheeler on his property late last night, and saw the campsite that Jakubowski had set up. There was a blue tarp that caught his eye, and he drove over and try to talk to the guy. He is a retired school counselor and ended up speaking with Jakubowski for about an hour without knowing who he was talking to. He tells this TV station, and he said it sounds like it was not a great conversation. He's quoted saying, in my background, you try to find some of the things that are positive in someone's life. He's one of the first people I have run into that there was just nothing I could find, at least in the onset, that made him positive. So it didn't go great. He called the guy wouldn't leave his property. So he called the local police, and they took him into custody this morning.
Interesting. And what do we hear from the Rock County Sheriff's Office as this manhunt progressed?
So this was taken very seriously. I think rightly so. This guy gave indications that he was going to, he was sort of in a mood to do something crazy. And I think it's, we have to count this as a positive. I think we can breathe a bit of a sigh of relief that no one ended up dead in this, at the end of this. It was very easy to imagine this ending in some form of violence, either from Jakubowski or otherwise. They will continue looking for, trying to track down and account for every one of the weapons that was stolen. Certainly there's still a question about what were other people involved? Was he acting on his own? He had somebody sort of taking a video of him before the initial burglary. So there are a lot of questions, and of course, this guy is going to face charges. But the sort of acute phase of the manhunt is over, and so that's the big news today.
Governor Walker had tweeted that he was proud of law enforcement in Wisconsin, county, municipal, federal. Do we know what kind of coordination there was for this effort?
It was all hands on deck, right? I think it was hard to know. You could sort of guess how long it would take him to travel a certain distance, right? But no one knows exactly how he was getting around, or whether he was working with others, or what his plans were. So essentially everyone within a pretty wide radius needed to be on alert. You can travel a long distance in a couple weeks. It's cited, whatever, more than 150 agencies were hunting for him. We had, from in my part of the world in central Wisconsin, there was a report someone had reported that in Juneau County he had been spotted, and so they had to sort of go on alert in Juneau County and take additional precautions with schools there. It turned out not to be the case, but I mean, so, you know, somebody in good faith had reported that they thought that they saw somebody who might have matched his description. That's the one that I happen to hear about, that we happen to report about at one of the newspapers I work with. But I have to assume that people are having similar experiences all over the state, because you sort of think, like, wait, could that be the guy?
And now we know. Well, Robert Menser is with us right now, storytelling editor for USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. And Robert, on Tuesday, more than 100 headlining acts for Milwaukee Summerfest were announced. It's a huge music festival. I guess it's the biggest in the country, it's billed as. Can you give us the highlights?
Summerfest is huge. People love it. Yeah, the biggest in the country. And this is the 50th year. This was bound to be a big one. The sort of biggest act, what will close out the festival, is sort of a bit of a festival within a festival. The Outlaw Music Festival on July 9th will feature Willie Nelson, Nobel laureate Bob Dylan, Sheryl Crow, and Jason Isbell, formerly of the Drive-By Truckers, and some others. So it's sort of a big, massive concert just on that night, and that's sort of the just the headlining acts of this huge festival.
Yeah, there's a ton. I read through them. Are you interested or invested in any of the particular acts, Robert?
Well, so this is, for sure, this is like the type of festival that you would have to work not to find something that you would like. I mean, like, I'm not going to go to the Willie Nelson and Bob Dylan show. I'll just reveal that to listeners. But if you, you know, as you get down below some of the, like, big amphitheater acts, it becomes more musically diverse. You know, Ziggy Marley is playing, the rap group Atmosphere. There are indie rock acts, Tegan and Sarah. So for sure, I mean, on the full bill, like, you will find something that appeals to you. It's a big festival, and there's a lot of, you know, whether you're into sort of massive arena shows or smaller club shows, there's a lot to do. There's a lot that goes on.
And nostalgia shows. I noticed that Hanson and Moody Blues and Slaughter are going to be there, just to name a few. So yeah, there really is something for everyone. Robert, you know what kind of impact Summerfest has on the state's tourism business?
So it is big. It is big business, and it is, I mean, for one thing, just a sort of headline, you know, claim, the nation's largest music festival is significant. There was a 2013 study that estimated the festival brings in $226 million for Wisconsin, about $187 million for Milwaukee specifically. You know, we should look at these estimates with, you should have a little bit of skepticism. It's hard to isolate exactly what spending wouldn't have happened without Summerfest. And, you know, presumably some people in Milwaukee stay home during Summerfest when they would have gone out because there's, you know, they don't want to fight the traffic or whatever. So it's, you know, even if it's a little iffy, still I think that gives you a sense of the overall impact. And it is significant. People visit from out of state. People go to see these bands. They pay for hotels and they eat at restaurants and so on. So yeah, no, I think it's a big deal.
And Rob, as we finish recapping the biggest state news, there's a big announcement from the Wisconsin State Department of Motor Vehicles. They're going to change the number of characters in Wisconsin's license plates. It has been 6, and it's going to get a bump up. What's the deal?
We have used up all the license plate numbers. Think about this. There are 20 million different combinations of the three-number, three-letter license plate combination that is on my car and perhaps yours. And Wisconsinites have run through all 20 million of them since this configuration debuted in 1986. So they're going to go up to 7 character plates. It'll be 3 letters and then 4 numbers, which they say gets us another 100 million plates, which seems like it should last us. I don't know if there are math savants going through the number of permutations, but I learned this from the Wisconsin State Journal story about this. License plates do not use I, O, or Q because those would be easily mistaken for numbers on the plate. So take that into account when you're counting up those 100 million different license plates.
Wow. So my question was, if you have a vanity license plate or a personalized license plate, can you use all letters? I could almost get to Veronica. I can get to Veronique or Veron 1.
You can for sure. You just got to use the 0. Use the 1 instead of the, you know, the O or the I.
Right. And we could do Packers and Badgers now, right? P-A-C-K-E-R-S, Badger. Yeah.
There are one of my favorite pieces of journalism. A couple years ago, somebody pulled together a list of all the banned vanity plates, things that people applied for in Wisconsin and were not allowed because they were dirty or mean or something. there was a lot of sucks as S-U-X. That was very popular in the among the banned license plates.
There's still
some places that we cannot go, is what I'm saying.
Interesting. Well, new options, though. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Robert Menzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. And he's with us every Friday to round up the top news of the past week. With the weather warming up, it's time to tune up the bike and hit the road. But one Eau Claire man is gearing up for a big ride, actually a 4,000-plus-mile trek across the country for charity. Matt Bolter joins us now. He's an Eau Claire native who's biking from coast to raise money and awareness for Syrian refugees. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So, Matt, how did you get this idea that you were going to take this bike trip and try to promote positivity and raise some money?
That's a very good question. So it comes from a couple different things. I guess the first thing that comes to mind is a couple months ago, I was living out in Washington State, and I had recently graduated college and was working a desk job that was ultimately unfulfilling. And I got a phone call from my stepdad informing me that my mother had had a stroke. So I ended up moving back to Eau Claire, actually, from Washington State to kind of help her along her path of recovery. So that experience in itself really made me reevaluate my own life and a lot of values that I hold, and also, more importantly, to really examine what I would want to do with this life, because it can be over in such a short time. And so that was one thing. And the other thing was, I had a conversation with a friend who I went to school with, graduated college with, and we were talking about how we were so aware of all these issues, both globally and locally, that are going on in our world that are very complex. And so we were speaking about these and, like, just being really appreciative to be aware of these. But at the same time, at college, it was like, okay, like, what are we actually doing to try to help tackle some of these very large and complex issues in the United States here, but also globally? So those two things really kind of culminated in this idea of me committing to taking steps and taking actual action to try to help solve at least part of a very large and complex issue that is happening in Syria.
Well, I hope your mom is doing well. Our best to her. And to talk about the charity you're working with and why you chose Syria, I understand that hunger came into the picture as you were working through some of these issues you were talking about. What struck you about the cause of hunger?
Yeah, most definitely. So basically, the third part of that story that I didn't mention in the previous question, I had also been reading a lot in the news about the incredible suffering that a lot of people in Syria are experiencing, but specifically women and children, because oftentimes they're the most vulnerable among any population. So I had read this news article actually about children in Yemen, which is a country fairly close to Syria, who were also experiencing suffering. And basically it was saying that the kids would eat garbage in order to stave off hunger. So I've just been sensing this really, really, really great need for assistance for food, shelter, and education through the news articles I've been reading. Specifically, I chose Save the Children organization because they already operate in 120 different countries around the world, and so they already have a lot of the a lot of the means necessary to directly help these people. And so specifically in Syria, I believe the UN just released a number that around 450,000 people have died in Syria just from the Syrian civil war for the past 5 years. And then along with that, I believe around 12 million are displaced, and 9 million of those 12 million have filed as refugees with the UN. So there's just incredible, incredible need out there, specifically for the children to kind of relieve some of their suffering in emotional terms, but also in physical terms of just getting their basic needs met, and that means shelter and food. So,
and I understand that you want to give all the money that you raise to charity. How are you raising money? Are people sponsoring you?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So basically, I've already held a couple fundraising events here in Eau Claire, which is where I actually grew up. And so those have been quite successful. The first event, we raised around $1,400. My end goal for Save the Children is to fundraise $10,000 by August 30th. So basically, I am funding this entire bicycle trip, like the food and all the equipment and everything. All of that, I'll be taking care of myself. I've been working a couple jobs the last 4 months to save up enough money to fund the trip myself, so that 100% of the proceeds go directly towards my $10,000 goal to save the children, to really help those children who are experiencing this great suffering.
We're talking with Matt Bolter right now, an Eau Claire native who's biking from coast to coast to raise money for Syrian refugees. And Matt, tell us about your route. How will you be traveling across the country?
Yeah, definitely. So I will be following a predetermined trail. It's called the Trans-America Trail. And it goes it starts in Yorktown, Virginia, and crosses the United States, almost bisecting it in half, and then going over to Colorado, and then turning north and heading west some more. So this route was established, I believe, in either 1974 or 76 by the Adventure Cycling Association. So it's a predetermined bike path. And along the way, I'll be interviewing people and posting those interviews to my blog, and kind of exploring the various opinions and the origins of those opinions surrounding refugees and immigrants in the United States.
Right. It sounds as though the conversations are something that you're especially interested in, and you want to have those and promote positivity as you go along. I'm curious about the positivity aspect, because right now we live in a country that is, in many cases, divided. People have strongly held opinions, often from different divides, different perspectives. What makes you so confident that you're going to have good conversations that open doors and lead to understanding?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. I really view this whole experience as a learning experience. I think that when we build very rigid identity walls that separate ourselves from other people, not only globally as United States citizens, but also locally, there are a lot of local community members that you may separate yourselves from, whether they're experiencing homelessness or they're of a different religion, or if they're of a different political viewpoint. And I believe that this really hinders our ability to work together to solve some of these issues, because in my short life, I've really come to believe pretty strongly that in order to tackle any of these very complex issues, we're going to need all the help we can get, and working together is really the only way. So I guess viewing other people in terms of our shared humanity and the value, their intrinsic worth as human beings, rather than viewing them as an other or through other surface level identifiers, really allows us to be more compassionate to ourselves and also to other people. And I believe when we view things that way, it'll really be a lot easier to even approach any of these issues that have become very political from a viewpoint of closer to our shared humanity rather than separating ourselves.
And I wonder if you would talk a little bit about your training. Have you had a lot of time to train and get in good biking shape for this massive trip?
Oh, that's a good question as well. So I have been working quite a bit, and on my days off, I have biked quite a bit as well. I got a pretty good deal on a bike from a local bike shop here in Eau Claire, and so I have been training quite a bit to try to get in shape for this trip. It is 4,000 miles, but over the 3 months that I'm going to be taking to make this trip, that averages out to around 40 miles a day, which may sound like a lot, but really, if you take it day by day and realize that you'll have 8 hours a day to bike that far, then just taking it day by day and breaking it up really makes a big difference as well.
And Matt, if someone wants to follow you or maybe to donate, what is the blog site that we should go to keep up with what you're doing and how it's going?
Oh, definitely. So I can tell you of two different websites. One is my blog, which is a WordPress blog, and I have my own domain to that. So it's www.thoughtforfoodtour.com. And then the second website I'll direct you to is my Facebook page. So it's facebook.com/thoughtforfoodtour. That's all one word and all lowercase for both websites. And so, yeah, you can go there. There should be links to my donation page through Save the Children on both websites. And the donations are tax deductible. So if anyone feels the need to donate or feels the spirit move you, you can visit those websites and find out more information and or follow along on my bike tour. So.
Well, Matt, this sounds excellent, and I wish you nothing but the best of luck. Thanks for talking today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, and have a wonderful rest of your day.
That was Matt Bolter, an Eau Claire native who's biking from coast to coast to raise money for Syrian refugees. For many of us, it may seem as though 2018 is far away, but for political parties and candidates, it's just around the corner. This is true, too, for Wisconsin's gubernatorial race next year. Currently, Governor Scott Walker hasn't officially announced that he'll seek re-election, even though it's widely believed that he will. But Democrats haven't got candidates lining up either, which is leaving some political junkies scratching their heads. Alan Greenblatt joins us now. He's a political reporter for Governing. Alan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on. I apologize. I'm a little scratchy with a spring cold.
Ah, that makes two of us, so we're in good company. So, Alan, in the greater scheme of gubernatorial races nationwide, how does Wisconsin compare?
Well, next year there are going to be 36 races for governor. Most of the races for governor are off of the presidential year, and there are going to be a lot of competitive seats. Republicans are defending, I think they're defending 27 of them. And in a lot of states, you know, in most states, excepting yours and a few others, the governors are term limited. So a lot of those seats are going to be open. And as a result, we have a lot of open seats that are looking more competitive so far than Wisconsin's.
And you've written that unseating Scott Walker for Democrats would be a big prize. Why is that? What is it about this particular governor seat?
Well, it's this particular governor, Scott Walker, is disliked by Democrats, certainly in Wisconsin. He's a very polarizing figure in your state, as you know better than I do, and also nationwide. I mean, he was a presidential contender for about 5 minutes, but Democrats all over the country dislike him because of Act 10, which the 2011 law that stripped collective bargaining rights from most public employees. And, of course, since then, Wisconsin has become a right-to-work state, so that has also hurt unions in the private sector. In Wisconsin, you know, this is a Republican era in state government, has been. Walker was elected in 2010 along with the what we call the Tea Party wave of Republicans. They took over, I think, two dozen legislative chambers nationwide that year, including both the chambers, both the House and Senate in Wisconsin. And since then, Wisconsin has been at the forefront of a lot of conservative types of legislation, whether it's voter ID laws or abortion restrictions or, like I say, the union busting. You can go on down the list, and Walker has been near the top. And, you know, he's often caricatured as a crony of Alec and the Koch brothers. And for all those things, he's kind of a symbolic bête noir for progressives.
And he hasn't officially, as I said, announced that he's running. He's hinted broadly, and people are sort of assuming that this is a done deal. But is there any reason that you can think of that might be holding him back from making that announcement, you know, sooner rather than later?
This time in 2009, he had announced when he was, you know, he'd already been running for a while when he was the Milwaukee County Executive. It's not particularly late. I mean, this is a season where a lot of candidates are announcing all over the country. But as an incumbent, he can afford to wait. You know, he can make up his mind later. I'm presuming he's going to run. He's still pretty young, and there's no other obvious office for him to go to. And he's been in political life his whole career. So I assume he's going to run, and he'll do it at a time when he thinks he'll get the maximum impact, maybe after the legislative session is over.
And in the meantime, you might think that Democratic challengers might be getting out there, getting some name recognition, fundraising, but that hasn't happened. In fact, we've seen, I think it was just last week, three contenders say no, they were not going to challenge Governor Walker, including former state senator Tim Cullen. Is this kind of par for the course when it's earlier, or has it been kind of hard for Democrats to get a strong candidate going up against Governor Walker?
Well, they don't have a candidate going. They have this one young fellow who's moved in from California. He's 25 years old. But that's it. I mean, you know, usually there'd be some rumblings. You know, even if somebody wasn't officially announced, you would know that he was running or she was running because they'd be out raising money. They'd be going to events. And they just don't have a body right now against Walker. And that's what interested me. He should be, a target Democrats would want to go after. And Democrats are pretty excited about 2018. You know, the president's party almost always loses elections and midterms, and President Trump is quite unpopular and certainly unpopular with Democrats. I mean, his approval ratings may tick back up, but right now they're pretty low. And so events like the special election in Kansas this week, where the congressional election where Democrats came within 7 points in a district where the incumbent had carried it by 33 points last November. I mean, Democrats feel like they should be fired up. They feel like this will be a good recruiting cycle, a good cycle for raising money. If you're a Democrat and you have your eye on an office, this looks like about as good a chance as, you know, this far out as you're likely to see.
So why do you think that is? Is it just that Scott Walker appears to be such a formidable candidate? He's, as he said, one of his slogans when he was running for president, battle tested. He's won 3 races effectually. I mean, is that it?
Yeah, he's won. He's won in different contexts. He won in a wave Republican year. He won in a recall situation, and he won in 2014, which was also a good Republican year. But Walker was looking vulnerable. The polls were not so great for him against Mary Burke in 2014, right until the end. He ended up winning, you know, pretty easily. And in all of his races, he's taken either 52% or 53% of the vote. So Wisconsin is closely divided, but he seems to be able to get just enough of a majority to win. He's certainly a massive fundraiser. He does have support from the Koch brothers and other big money donors nationwide. He's currently the chair of the Republican Governors Association, so his job is raising money all over the country for races at that level. So he's going to have a ton of money, and he seems to be able to eke out a win in a closely divided state.
We're talking with Alan Greenblatt right now, political reporter for Governing, and he's with us to talk about how the 2018 gubernatorial race may shape up, and you can join the conversation. Who would you like to see run in 2018? If you're a Republican, do you plan on voting for Governor Scott Walker maybe again? Or if you're a Democrat, who would you like to see run? Why do you think more challengers haven't stepped up for Democrats? You can reach us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about the upcoming Wisconsin governor's race with Alan Greenblatt. He's political reporter for Governing. And we want to hear from you on this. How do you think the 2018 race is going to shape up? Still pretty early yet, but Democrats have yet to line up many candidates to run against likely return candidate Scott Walker. And if you're a Republican, do you think you'll vote for Scott Walker if he runs again? Right now, approval ratings in the low to mid 40s there. Or do you think you'd like to see someone new? If you're a Democrat, who would you like to see challenge Governor Walker? Call us at 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. And we take our first caller now. We have Zach joining us in La Crosse. Zach, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm a student in the La Crosse, Wisconsin area, and I'm wondering, why doesn't Russ Feingold run against Governor Walker? I know he lost in the Senate race, but I just think with all of his experience, he would be a really strong candidate.
Zach, thank you for that. And some folks in Wisconsin, I'm sure Zach's not the only one, curious about why Russ Feingold has not expressed an interest in running for governor. Do you have any insight on that particular question, Alan?
Well, I haven't talked to former Senator Feingold myself, so I couldn't say. But, you know, he did lose just last year. And, you know, in politics, you can lose once, you can lose twice. But, yeah, maybe not even twice at that level. So he just lost. He looked like he was ahead all year long against Senator Johnson, and he ended up losing pretty handily. And this points to another problem for Democrats. They just don't have other bodies to throw up against Walker. They don't have another statewide elected official except for the Secretary of State, which is more or less a ceremonial office in your state. They only have three members of Congress. Tammy Baldwin is up next year, so she'll be running for re-election. And that's a problem for Democrats in a lot of states. They don't have officials with statewide name recognition or statewide offices. And in your state, and as in a lot of others, the Democratic vote is very concentrated. Almost all the Democratic vote now is in Madison and Milwaukee. And so the office holders are from those areas and won't play that well in the rest of the state. The same problem in Minnesota, the Democratic Party is having there, where almost all their support is in Minneapolis-St. Paul, and the rest of it just doesn't play in the rest of the state.
So just briefly before we get back to callers, there's a lot of them, but why do you think that is? Why is the bench so thin for Democrats in Wisconsin and outside of Wisconsin?
Well, Democrats took a beating during the Obama years. It's been sort of widely pointed out. They obviously lost control of Congress, both houses, over the course of the presidency, and they lost more than 900 state legislative seats. They were just wiped out, and their vote is really concentrated in the major metro areas, which we saw in the presidential race as well. You know, Hillary Clinton carried 88 of the nation's 100 largest counties, but practically nothing else. She only carried 490 counties nationwide, whereas Trump carried about 2,600. So the Democratic vote is very much an urban vote these days.
Take another caller. Now we have Diane joining us in Appleton. Hi, Diane.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. One thing I wanted to point out, I met with a candidate. I think the gentleman was referring to him. I tuned in late, Bob Harlow. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to enunciate a little bit. Bob is actually a native Wisconsinite. He comes from the area right around Barneveld, Wisconsin. But I wanted to say that he has a very, very well-defined progressive agenda that would definitely bring a lot of pride and cohesion back to a state that has been totally torn apart by Scott Walker. He's so innovative. And I think the Democrats want somebody that has new thoughts about what Wisconsin and the country needs. And Bob Harlow is just really innovative.
And Diane, thank you for calling. I appreciate that and sharing your thoughts on Bob Harlow. And I want to pick up on the last point Diane made, that she thinks the Democrats are ready for some fresh ideas, maybe some new blood. Is that something that maybe Democrats are up against at this particular point in time, that there was this huge paradigm shift in Washington with the election of Donald Trump, and now Democrats want to see that reflected in their politics?
Well, the Democratic base has done a good job of holding members of Congress' feet to the fire. I think right after the election, there was a lot of talk about would Democrats in Congress cooperate with the president, and all these protests and the flooding of the Capitol Hill switchboards has sort of strengthened the resolve. The base has led the politicians, and they're not going to cooperate with Trump on anything. And we're going to see the same sort of, you know, what we in the media will caricature as a Hillary Clinton establishment versus Bernie Sanders progressive wing divide. There's a governor's race this year in Virginia. The lieutenant governor looked like he was sailing to the nomination, and fairly late in the race in January, a former congressman got into the race, and he's been running on more the progressive side and is giving a real challenge. And it looks like he might be able to win. Anyway, so we're going to see this intra-party fighting. And, you know, we'll see in Wisconsin if there are enough candidates to reflect this, whether there's sort of the old school establishment, union oriented Democrats versus younger, perhaps even a non-white candidate, so forth. But one thing we should say is it may not matter. Whoever is the Democrat against Scott Walker is certain to get at least 45, maybe 48% of the vote. And if it does end up being a big Democratic wave year, it's with Democrats more fired up than Republicans, the opposite of what we saw in midterms in the Obama years, it's somebody who may not seem like a big power player going in, but that person may end up becoming the next governor. You know, the right person is in the right place at the right time.
Diane, thank you for that call as we talk with political reporter Alan Greenblatt about the 2018 race for governor in Wisconsin and why Democrats don't have a big field of challengers lining up to perhaps run against Scott Walker. And we'll go next to Terry in northern Wisconsin. Terry, hi.
Hi. I guess I was going to pick on a couple of guys from the lower part of the state, John Erpenbacher, state senator, I think, from Middleton, and Chris Larson, I think, from the Milwaukee area. Those are two fellows that, that I would support, either one.
All right, Terry, thank you for that. Terry recommending John Erpenbach or Chris Larson. And let's go on next to talk to Steve in Danbury. Steve, hello.
Hi. Well, I like all the ideas for possible Democratic candidates I've heard so far. I don't think it's late at all. In fact, I think most people are still suffering from campaign fatigue from the last election. But I think you will see Senator Kathleen Vinehout jump into the race. And I think she's a particularly strong candidate. She's a farmer from western Wisconsin who has an understanding of budgetary things that exceeds anybody I've ever heard. She's a compassionate individual, well-spoken, good sense of humor. She would be a very strong candidate.
All right. Steve, thank you for that thought there about Kathleen Vinehout. And Alan, you wrote a little bit in your piece about some changes in Wisconsin, including the Government Accountability Board being dismantled. Do you see that playing a role in all of this?
Well, you know, Governor Walker's had no trouble raising money anyway, but I think the lack of a serious ethics and elections oversight agency will, you know, certainly make it easier. There was the big question with the John Doe case about whether his campaign in 2010 illegally coordinated with outside groups. He has survived that legal challenge, but he'll have no trouble raising millions upon millions of dollars if he needs to. People are saying it's not too late to get into the race. That's certainly true. But whoever runs against him is going to have to raise, tens of millions of dollars, and they'll want to get started.
And Alan, as we wrap up, what have you heard from Democratic leaders at the state and the national level about whether they're concerned about this or whether they think, yeah, there's going to be someone good in this position. We just have to hang on a bit. If you're a Democrat and if you're a Republican, you feel confident that Scott Walker is going to run again and he's going to be strong.
Well, of course, they will say to a reporter that they're feeling plenty confident and they're going to have somebody. And, in the end, somebody with some real stature, not to denigrate Mr. Harlow, but, somebody who's a little more seasoned will come into the race, I'm sure. But, it's late and a lot of people have already said they're not going to run. And it's not just Wisconsin. The problems I've talked about where the base is all in the urban centers, there's not a statewide candidate with statewide profile going in. I mean, these are problems in Ohio and Iowa, in Michigan. These are states that Democrats should win, that they traditionally win in presidential years, that they won narrowly last year with Trump, but they're just not getting the horses.
Alan, we leave it there. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Alan Greenblatt is a political reporter for Governing, joining us to talk about the 2018 race for governor in Wisconsin.